Thank you, Chris. We'd now like to start off the question and answer session with the questions posted online. Once we get through those questions, if time allows, we will open up the phone lines for questions. My first question is for Chris. What are the public sector costs you attribute to the high cost estimate for freight rail improvements?
Yeah, okay, that's a good question. Since the railroads are under most generally private entities that run that manage the rail infrastructure, I think what you might see is if the public sector is looking to accelerate improvements beyond what the private sector is capable of or willing to finance, there would be costs. There potentially in terms of if there's a, you know, if it's financing either loans or grants for improvements of rail infrastructure. And you do see in some cases states taking control over, for example, short line railroads that provide more local access. So I think the question is, you know, how much does the public sector try to want to accelerate what is being done beyond where the private sector will do itself?
Thank you, Chris. Another question for you. What do you think about the ongoing shift from direct rail service to truck service, only sometimes shifting intermodally on the rail network, sometimes door to door by truck?
I think there's, I mean, the issue of intermodal, I mean, we've certainly been getting, we're seeing a lot more of that in recent years in terms of containers, trucks on flat cars, that sort of thing. You know, so I certainly think there's more potential in that area. Part of it will depend on kind of the density of the freight movements, and do you have enough freight density to support the infrastructure to make that happen? And you know, in areas where you don't have a lot of freight density, you may not even you know, it may be hard to kind of develop the intermodal infrastructure. But, you know, certainly looking at, you know, like hoping to see more kind of creative applications of shifting from one mode to another and you know, using lower cost methods.
Thank you. And another question for you, Chris. Oops, sorry, I lost it there. Oh, Chris, in evaluating the effectiveness and benefits of rail technology, did you look at the idle reduction technology usable with conventional locomotives like AESS, APUs, shore power, and yard air?
Yes, that's actually a, yeah, that's a good comment for locomotives that the idle reduction technology is another. Is another strategy that should be considered, and I think I neglected to put that on the list. You know, I think that's going to be most effective in areas where you have again in yards, you know, switching yards. So I think probably some of the switching locomotives is going to be a lot more effective than you know the longer distance movements. But yeah, that has been so, shown actually I think to be a fairly cost-effective strategy.
Again, thank you, Chris. Now, this question has already been partially addressed by Frank Gallivan, but I'd like to give the other speakers an opportunity to answer. How, if at all, do your modal outputs present uncertainty in their values?
This is Mikhail. So uncertainty can result from a variety of different dimensions in the analyses. So in my presentation, the first one I showed results that were per ton kilometer, for example. So when I think about uncertainty, I think about it in terms of the, you know, underlying data that is used, that are used, that would be parameter uncertainty. But then as you saw in some of the latter figures, I had scaled things up to, you know, what would happen into the future. So that gets us into, for example, scenario uncertainty. So Regarding the first parameter uncertainty, you know, we tend to do a, you know, I would say a robust uncertainty assessment that considers all sorts of information about the underlying data that we use. So it includes the geographical representativeness of the underlying data. So, for example, whether or not an emission factor that we're using is for, I live in Arizona, so for Arizona, or if it was developed for another state, and then we ask, what does that mean? We think about the temporal uncertainty of the data that we're using. So, you know, generally we're not using data that was developed yesterday. We're using data that were developed maybe, you know, a year ago or 5 years ago or sometimes 10 years ago. And then we ask questions about whether or not the data that we're using are reasonable for what's happened today or whether or not there's been innovation that we need to take into account. So we think about the underlying parameter uncertainty in a variety of different ways. We have a structured way of doing it, an uncertainty, developing our uncertainty assessment, which ultimately gives us insight into where we focus our efforts to improve data quality. So, you know, that gives us a sense of whether or not in our revisions to our life cycle assessments, we should focus on one factor in our model versus another. And, you know, what we tend to do is focus on the pieces that have the highest uncertainty first and the greatest effect on the overall results. And we, you know, we say, what could we do better? And maybe that's sometimes going out and collecting the data ourselves, or it's doing another round of modeling of the underlying data to improve that.
Thank you, Mikhail. Another question for you. How do you account for the proportion of infrastructure, roadways, etc., related emissions ascribable to freight-carrying trucks versus on-road vehicles?
Terrific question. And I glossed over this. I didn't mention it at all, actually. So the way that we do it, I'll tell you how we do it first and then the reasoning for that. The way we do it is we assign all of the construction impacts of roads to cars in the model results that you saw. And then we assign all of the rehabilitation impacts to trucks. And the reason for this is because damage to roadways is a fourth power relationship of axle load. So essentially the damage that's done to roads is almost entirely heavy-duty vehicles. So, you know, the rehabilitation of roads essentially is allocated to trucks, whereas roadways are designed capacity-wise based on largely based on passenger cars, which are the bulk of the volume in many places. So that's the reasoning behind that. In the Fasania 2007 results that I showed, the very first figure that I showed done in 2007, they had actually allocated impacts of roadways based on the somehow the economic valuation of roads between passenger and freight. And that leads to something like a 60-40 split between passenger and freight. So that was initially how we thought about it maybe 10 years ago, but we've moved more towards allocation mechanisms that include actual measures of damage based on the sort of physical principles of roadway maintenance and rehabilitation.
Thank you again. One of the other questions that we had, a couple related to the use of the tool and who was using it, and I wanted to give the speakers an opportunity to discuss that more, what organizations are testing the tools, and any further discussion on that?
This is John here. There have been sort of a couple of components in terms of the process for engaging practitioner perspective. As we were developing the tool, we had an informal advisory group that comprised representatives of both MPOs and DOTs. We got a lot of really good input from that that group, and especially from NYSDOT and Caltrans. We also had a fairly sort of accelerated phase of a pilot testing the tool before releasing it. I may actually, if Jeff or Frank, you can please feel free to chime in, but in addition to the advisory group, which again included Caltrans, NYSDOT, and actually someone from Pikes Peak Regional Council, we had offers to pilot test the tool, I guess, by a couple of additional MPOs, including, let me think here, it was NCT COG, we had some interest from SACOG, and let me think, is there any?
Sandag,
yes. Sandag, I'm sorry, yeah. Was it SACOG, it was Sandag, yeah.
Right.
Does that cover it, Frank or Jeff?
Yeah, that's it from what I remember.
So in any event, as I indicated in the chat box, the sort of the most active pilot tester was NCT COG. They essentially evaluated system level emissions associated with their LRTP. But it's all to say that and I think it's some of the questions were intimating that, I mean, there are a whole lot of different ways the tool can be used. I mean, you can use it, sort of in the simplest way, at say a regional level or at a state level, just to for inventory purposes. So you can go from just having a lot of MPOs have inventories of tailpipe emissions, from transportation sources, but this is serves as a foundation for developing the an infrastructure component. And again, to say that this is it's a kind of strategy that that public agencies have a lot of control over. And and then if you took it a step further, you could use the tool, for instance, to, and this would be fairly simple, but just to evaluate the greenhouse gas, potential greenhouse gas reductions associated with various green construction and maintenance strategies. But then you could also use it to evaluate some sort of decisions that would be tied to planning. So for instance, I sort of started getting at this in response to the chat pod, but you could evaluate various scenarios of transportation investment. So if there's a question of how your entire system performs, you could use the carbon estimator to provide an estimate of various the greenhouse gas emissions that would be associated with different sort of levels of infrastructure investment. And then you could use a travel model plus moves to come up with the corresponding vehicle operations estimates, and when you bring those two pieces together, you can you can compare the sort of overall system performance of the impacts of various various investment scenarios, again at the system level, and FHWA's position has typically been that greenhouse gas analysis is most sort of meaningful at the system level. But if you have an interest in evaluating project specific emissions, the tool can be scaled down to evaluate those as well, and so that would be another way that you could use the tool, would be again to evaluate various sort of alternatives for a NEPA analysis, and then again that would serve as a foundation for providing those construction estimates that tend that are very, very uncommonly part of NEPA work, and sort of push the state of practice there. So I don't know, Jeff or Frank, do you have anything to add on that front?
Well, this is Jeff. I'll just add that the tool has only been out for a few months, and we're still sort of in outreach mode here. But you know, we expect interest will grow, especially if CEQ finalizes our climate change guidance, and we need to start looking at greenhouse gas impacts of more projects. I'll also, Abby asked a question in the chat pod that I'll address. She asked if the construction dollar costs factor into the 12-month payback, 10-month payback period for that case study. This is just an emissions payback exercise, not a cost payback exercise. But you know that you do bring up an interesting concept, and that is that when we reviewed climate action plans from different states, many of them have a transportation component where the climate action plan will say, you know, we're gonna build more transit, or we're gonna build HOV lanes, or we're gonna build bike paths, right? And the plans calculate the benefits of those strategies, but none of the plans account for the emissions required to build the stuff in the first place, right? And in the context of greenhouse gas emissions, where the construction emissions impact the atmosphere just as much as the vehicle emissions, it's really important to consider those construction impacts. So if you're looking at two different strategies that can reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 1,000 tons per year, and one of them has a 10-month payback period and another one has a 10-year payback period, you know, that could be useful information to the people that are, you know, deciding which strategies to fund.
Thank you, Jeff. I believe most of the questions have been answered at this point. Did you gentlemen want to expand upon anything that you answered in the chat earlier? If not, I'll go ahead and open up the phone lines for any questions.
If you'd like to ask a telephone question at this time, please press star then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Again, if you'd like to ask a telephone question, please press star then the number one on your telephone keypad. There are no telephone questions at this time. I'll turn the call back over to Ms. Cooney.
Thank you. Well, that concludes our seminar for today. Thank you for attending. The recorded version of this event will be available within the next few weeks on the Talking Freight website. The next seminar will be held on May 20th, and the topic is to be determined. Registration is not yet available, but I will send a notice out through the Freight Planning Listserv announcing the topic and the availability of registration. I encourage you to join the Freight Planning Listserv if you have not already done so.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.